We are keeping democracy live. I'm Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The dignity of humanity. That's what government, one of the roles of government is to help people and to bring about peace and justice in the world. And it is my real honor today to have as guest someone who I voted for president enthusiastically in 2008. For more than 30 years, Bill Richardson has led a distinguished public service. Governor Richardson, it is really an honor. I was very pleased to vote for you in 2008 here in New Hampshire. And
I appreciate that. I do. Thank you.
Well, millions of people around the world are appreciative of the efforts of this amazing, distinguished public servant. And I tried to look at his intro and see what I could cut. It's amazing. I can't cut it. So stick with me for a while. He was member of Congress from 1982 to 1996, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations from 97 and 98, Secretary of Energy under President Bill Clinton, 98 to 2000. And in 2008, he sought the Democratic nomination for president through Iowa and New Hampshire. And as a diplomat and special envoy, Bill Richardson has received 4 Nobel Peace Prize nominations and has successfully won the release of hostages and American servicemen in North Korea, Cuba, Iraq, and the Sudan. Since entering life as a private citizen in 2011, he's authored 3 books, including How to Sweet Talk a Shark, Strategies and Stories from Master Negotiator. And I understand the person who's in the White House now is terrified of sharks. Well, it was published in the fall of 2013. Governor Richardson is active on the national and international speech circuit and appears frequently on numerous TV programs, CNN, Fox, Univision, This Week with George Stephanopoulos. As governor of New Mexico from 2003 to 2011, Richardson's bold governing style moved New Mexico forward in several important areas, including clean energy, education, transportation, healthcare, immigration, environmental protection, $1 billion in tax cuts to New Mexicans. He vastly improved the state's job numbers and improved economic development by bringing the movie industry to New Mexico, which resulted in more than 140 major film and TV productions. He's also built a light rail system from Albuquerque to Santa Fe and partnered with Virgin Galactic to build a commercial spaceport. During his administration, more than $1 billion was invested in public schools, including professional salaries to recruit and retain quality teachers. He also shifted education money away from the administration and into the classroom, and increased access to early childhood education. In 2010, he was named Best Education Governor by the National Education Administration. How could I cut out any of that? It's super impressive. Well, here we are. Again, thank you very much, Governor Richardson. I know we only have about a half an hour. I remember 1968-69 with President Nixon. Theoretically, the head of the State Department, the Secretary of State, was William Rogers. But really, Henry Kissinger was running the show. Why is the State Department so important? And what, I mean, now that Rex Tillerson has been kicked out, what is the reality about the State Department? Do we have one? And how does that affect American security and strength?
Well, Bert, thank you for that nice introduction. The State Department is key in our diplomacy and national security because it contains diplomats that have been trained for years, have served in different countries around the world, and they frame our national security and diplomatic efforts. This has been bipartisan, Republican and Democrats. The problem has been that under the Trump administration, Secretary of State Tillerson decimated the State Department by treating it like a private sector matrix enterprise, and that doesn't work. Relationships are important around the world, and a lot of diplomats retired, left the service, almost decimating the entire department of its expertise. For instance, we're going to negotiate with North Korea, but we don't have an ambassador to South Korea. We don't have a special envoy on North Korea. So here is that expertise at state. And I'm wondering also, we have no Middle East, Near East negotiator, yet here we're in a potential crisis with Syria right now. So it's disturbing. And the State Department, more than any other agency, the Department of Defense, National Security Council, that's where the expert diplomats are that get us out of trouble, that give options to the president of diplomacy before military force, soft power, human rights, and this department right now is really suffering.
And it doesn't seem like there's any interest on the part of this administration in even the idea of diplomacy. It just seems like, you know, you just got to be tough guy and project this image around the world, never mind that it changes minute by minute. Well, you're all, I mean, one of the many difficult areas around the world that you're involved in, and I believe making a difference, is Myanmar. People don't hear about that very much. What's going on there? How is your diplomacy helping? What is the situation there?
Well, it's a very tragic situation, Bert. There's 1 million refugees that are in dire straits, that are stranded in Bangladesh. They're Rohingyas from Myanmar that have been pushed out, that have been human rights violations. Many have ended up in mass graves, not allowed to have UN supervision and repatriation efforts, safety. Many have ended up human rights violations, massive rapes. And what needs to happen is my diplomacy, my international efforts have been focused on helping those refugees get repatriated back to Myanmar. And I had a very bad experience with a former heroine who was my friend, Aung San Suu Kyi. I was in Burma. I was in Myanmar. And I said, look, you got to take care of this problem. These are, your military is killing a lot of these people. And she didn't listen. We had a breakup in our relationship. She got mad at me and told me this was not a good charter for the commission that she had appointed me to improve the situation. So just in short, Bert, the international community, the United States, we need to participate in helping this situation, which is genocide, ethnic cleansing. We need to use the force of our power and our diplomacy to push Myanmar, to push the various military leaders in Myanmar, to stop these killings, to repatriate these refugees. The monsoon season is about to start in Bangladesh, and these are human beings that there's a million of them, and there many of them are hungry. They're worried about their future. They want to go back home to Myanmar, and they're mistreated by the military in Myanmar, by the monks there, by the entire very dire human rights situation. We shouldn't just worry about North Korea and Syria, the strategic areas. We should worry about people. And this is where I think diplomacy is most important.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. I'm honored to say our guest today is former Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico, who's doing tremendous diplomacy work across the globe. And I imagine a lot of the, I don't know many Trump supporters, so I'll have to just imagine, I'm not sure that they see the value of diplomacy. I mean, okay, the people of Myanmar are suffering. Why should we care? Why is it of interest to us? I mean, just looking at it from that cold point of view, is there an argument to say, hey, yeah, this really is in our interest?
Bert, the United States is considered the world's leader, diplomatic, intellectual, moral, political, human rights. But when we abdicate that leadership and say to the Saudi Arabias and the Philippines and other countries that violate human rights, and we say to them, hey, you know, it's just important to be our military strategic friends.
Right.
Egypt, I'd throw in there. That shrinks our value around the world. And what I say to the Trump supporters, what I say to the international community, is that it's in our interest, it's in our political and moral interest to be engaged in the world. The world looks to us. Even the Chinas look to us. What's America's first step going to be? How are they going to respond to this crisis? I think right now with Syria, the international community is awaiting. What are we going to do about stopping Assad from using these chemical weapons? Again, how's it going to affect Russia and Iran and other powers? So, you know, we can't shrink and say we're going to be isolationists, as President Trump does. America first. Well, that sounds good. Let's protect our people and our national security and our jobs. That doesn't mean you abdicate. You get out of the free trade agreement with Mexico. You get out of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership with 15 other countries. China has moved in there, where you don't respect our European allies at NATO, as we have with President Trump. So, you know, this is opposite of what America stands for. Bipartisan, Bush, Clinton, Obama. We're an internationalist nation, and to shrink into our own personal isolationist tendencies, build a wall in Mexico, National Guard at the border, that's not America. America is inclusive. America is human rights oriented. We're people oriented. We're a nation of immigrants. I mean, I spent a lot of time in states like New Hampshire. Eileen Spratt Ellers, my friend, supporter there. I mean, she, like all of us, we're immigrants.
We are. I certainly am. And you have a mix of different background in your own blood. And talking about, you know, America first, one thing we don't hear a lot about, but the new Saudi prince was making a royal trip around the United States these days. And it seems like the United States is just supporting whatever the Saudis do in that area. And that affects us tremendously in the Middle East. I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, with their whole horrible war on the people of Yemen, that it seems to me the side that we are supporting is making things a heck of a lot worse there. What are we doing about the Saudi experience?
Well, I think we have to see how that Saudi prince governs. I'm concerned, too. I'm concerned with a war in Yemen. I'm concerned that they're not participating, the Saudis, in the Middle East peace process. I'm concerned with their human rights violations, although the Saudi prince says he's trying to modernize the Saudi society by, well, his first step was allowing women to drive. Well, you know, he should go way beyond that.
You think?
You know, Saudi Arabia, the oil diplomacy, because we've become a major producer of natural gas, oil, renewables. You know, the Saudis, OPEC, they're not as important as they used to be, but they are key players in the Middle East. And I worry that, you know, they're not big on human rights. They don't support human rights efforts around the world. That, you know, we're getting too close to them. And the Saudi prince is on an offensive in the United States, around the world. But I think maybe he is moving in the right direction, rooting corruption, maybe slowly improving Saudi domestic society, human rights reforms. But I'm skeptical, and I worry that, you know, with the Saudis, with the Dutertes of the Philippines, we're too close to human rights dictators.
Duterte is just beyond belief. We won't get into it here, but if you do a little research, dear listener, you won't believe what this ally is over there. And, you know, talk about America first and making America strong. A little bit domestic issue. You were named best education governor by the National Education Administration. What about this Betsy DeVos? What about the policy of the current Republican administration with regard to public education? How do you see that affecting America? And are people getting any potential damage that may be causing to our future?
Well, I think Betsy DeVos is probably the worst education secretary we've ever had because she doesn't understand the value of public education. You know, she's never had any experience in it, and her policies at the Education Department have been anti-teacher, anti-early childhood education with a massive budget cuts. They have not promoted a lot of the minority schools around the country, the Native American, Hispanic schools in states like mine. They are just deeply involved in trying to bring in a voucher system. You know, charter schools, I was supportive of charter schools, but with strong regulation. And I think if Betsy DeVos had her way, we would be on a voucher system with every school being charter-oriented. And she doesn't just understand the value of public education, but our community colleges, our university system, you know, for private institutions, positive policies, and the rest of our education system, and not getting the proper leadership from that department. So I'm very distressed, and I've been close to the teachers for years, you know, the NEA, the AFT, and they're in a state of extreme concern over not protecting our teachers, not paying them properly. You know, this teacher, she's been promoting these armed teachers. It's not a solution to our educational problems with safety in our schools.
No, the idea of crossfire in a kindergarten bothers me just a little bit. You know, and education is, how can it be America First if we're undercutting our own education? And I got to delve a little bit into politics. What happened in 2016? The state of the Democratic Party. I almost feel sorry for Republicans now who, you know, it's got to be very challenging for them to distance themselves from the president of the United States. But I wonder if you could talk about those domestic political issues, the state of the Democratic Party now and what happened in 2016 and what opportunities we may have.
Well, I believe there's a wave emerging in the 2018 elections. Democrats, I think we're going to do well. I bet you we narrowly win the House. Possibly the Senate. You never know.
Yeah.
We need to develop an economic message. I think the fact that Speaker Ryan's retirement announcement speaks volumes. He doesn't want to preside over the turning over of the House or probably remain an ally of the Trump administration. He's been burned, and you know, he wants to get out. The one thing I will say is I think it's very important to develop new leaders in the party, an economic message that translates into higher wages for our people.
Yes.
I know in New Hampshire and the Northeast, this is obviously a huge issue. Yeah. One thing, Bert, Hillary Clinton, we should stop criticizing her. I mean, this woman ran for president, ran a good race, is an inspiration to millions of women. I know she lost. I know there were errors committed in her race, but you know, I just finished reading her book, What Happened. She delves into some of those issues and her own feelings. I think we should lay off of her. Yes, we do need to develop new faces. You know, I personally like Joe Biden or a new face as our candidate, but again, with Hillary Clinton, let's appreciate her and not keep downgrading her, as I keep seeing from some of our Democratic friends.
Well, I was a big Bernie supporter. I think he would have been a much stronger candidate. But in the end, I worked hard to gather the Bernie people who were reticent to support our nominee. Yes. And it's a heck of a lot better than this thing there. You know, we have to unite. We absolutely have to unite for the sake of the country. And I find it fascinating. I got a mailing yesterday. I don't know how I got on Ted Cruz's mailing list, but he's using impeachment as a way to raise money. That, wow, if we don't have a Republican majority in the House, then these left-wing Democrats could go for impeachment. I'm not sure if that's helping our cause. What are your thoughts about such things?
Well, I think it's desperation. Ted Cruz is in a real fight for the Senate in Texas against a young congressman named Beto O'Rourke.
Yes.
And he's running a little scared. You know, Texas is a tough state for Democrats to win. I think Republicans, especially up for re-election, are using this impeachment issue to fire up their base, to raise more money.
Right.
It's very unfortunate. And by the way, I think Bernie Sanders did a lot on positive things for the party in terms of issues and health care. So I'm not you know, I'm not criticizing his wing, which is the dominant wing of the party today.
Yeah.
I just think what we need to do, Bert, is combine the Sanders social justice progressives with those traditional moderate Democrats, for instance, that have appreciated the unions again. I mean, I'm a big pro-union guy.
Absolutely.
This Connor Lamb election in Pennsylvania shows that if we have an economic message that involves our old coalition of progressives and unions and working people, we're going to do okay.
I believe we will if we get back to the old Democratic message. People, I mean, there was the clear Republican message, make America great again, and we got to connect. We got to reconnect with people. And what about, I don't know if you would consider yourself one of the young people coming up in the ranks. 2020 is right around the corner. We need people with vision to win. I supported you in 2008, and you have a fantastic reputation across America and the world. Are you looking at 2020? You must have a ready answer for that one.
The answer is very clear. No, Bert. I had my shot. You know, I loved running. I think you basically have one shot, although others have come twice or three times. No, I am happy with my foundation, with my private sector work. You know, we're involved with North Korea. We're involved with political prisoners, protecting elephants, animals around the world. But I do think we need to develop a new face somewhere.
There are some
mayor, governor, senator, congressman out there. Or, you know, I see Joe Biden. He combines the best of the Obama coalition with traditional working people.
Yes.
And, you know, he's criticized for being a little old, but, you know, geez, that's changed in our society.
Yes.
But I appreciate your nice words, but I had my shot. I mean, I hope to be involved with the issues affecting the country, as I have been.
I
think we need a new face somewhere, too, besides the Joe Bidens and the Bernie Sanders.
We got a lot of new faces out there, some really terrific people, and they're eager for it, of course. You probably knew Dale Bumpers, who was senator from Arkansas a long time ago. I asked him if he was going to run. He said, well, the qualities that are essential to run a successful campaign are the very same qualities which should disqualify you from ever holding the office.
Yeah, you know, he was a wonderful speaker. You remember he gave that speech on the Clinton impeachment in the Senate, which I think basically won the vote, although Clinton was not going to get impeached in the Senate or convicted.
No.
But I remember Bumpers. He was the best speaker.
He was
kept
great.
Talking about values and human rights.
No, I know. And from Arkansas.
Arkansas produced a lot of good politicians besides Bumpers and President Clinton.
Yeah, it's
true. And Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Although I guess she's got roots in Illinois and New York and everywhere else.
Well, you need to have roots everywhere. Well, we sort of touched on North Korea. You know, when President Trump was blustering against North Korea, you know, now they're planning on talking. Oddly enough, I feel like I have a little bit of hope that they might get together and there might be some sort of peace arrangement between South Korea, North Korea, the U.S. You've been in it rather deeply. What do you think about the possibilities for peace there?
Well, you know, I am not a big supporter of President Trump in any way, but I
come
out publicly and say, and I've been to North Korea 8 times and negotiated with him, that it was the right move for him to accept Kim Jong-un's invitation for a face-to-face dialogue. Why do I see that? One, things couldn't get worse in the peninsula as they have been with the tension with South Korea and Japan and North Korea shooting missiles. They've got 20 to 60 nuclear weapons, Bert, you know, so I think something had to happen.
Yeah.
Now, I think the summit is a good idea, but I worry, Bert, that we're not going to be prepared, that we're going to be unrealistically expecting them to totally denuclearize.
Right.
They're not going to do that.
No.
But I think it's worth examining putting limits on their missiles, on their nuclear activity. We've also got 3 Americans that are detained there.
Hmm.
We also have the remains of thousands of our soldiers from the Korean War. I was able to bring 7 back in 2007 from North Korea. I think those are also worthy goals. But it's a very important summit. My hope is the president stops his tweeting, stops his taunting of the North Korean leader, listens to his advisors, although he, you know, they're not confirmed. They're,
it's a revolving door.
Pompeo is just going through his hearing, so yeah. I worry that we're not going to be prepared, and he's going to go and not be and just wing it. That's my worry, but it's a good thing. So I'm going to give him credit for that and for additional pressure on North Korea from China. I think that was a good move, so I'll give him those two pieces of credit.
Hey, same here. I'm no fan of the president. What a surprise. But hey, if this can work. But again, it comes back to the idea of diplomacy. Just winging it, you got to have diplomacy. People who do the research, who get into it, who understand what motivates people. And without that, yeah, it's a worrisome situation. One quick last thing. I read an article that frankly blew me away about the emoluments clause of the Constitution, the corruption. This is not making headlines. It's not Stormy Daniels. It's not the Russia stuff. But this corruption, it's almost like this president sees the whole job as being a way to enrich himself and other people. I get a sense that perhaps legally this could be what brings him down. None of this other glitzy stuff. What are your thoughts about that whole corruption stuff?
Well, I think what's most important here for the country and for our Constitution and our, you know, our division of the courts and the Congress and the executive branch is the investigation of Robert Mueller. I mean, he seems to be looking at the entire Trump operation with Russia, the collusion issue, the issues of improper financial arrangements. And I think what we need to do is really, one, ensure, find ways that we protect Mueller.
Yes.
I don't know if he gets fired, how you do that. I would hope there's a revolt that happens.
Oh, yeah.
But secondly, I think this guy is really delving into some very important issues, and maybe nothing is going to come out of it.
Possibly.
But at the very least, we should be supportive of a path that he's taken that I think is not just a common sense, sensible path, but a legal path.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's people like you, quite frankly, that make me proud to be an American. You understand our role in the world. You do something about it. You have made a difference on I don't know how many lives, education, international diplomacy. Thank you for your continued work.
Thank
I hope you keep it up.
Thank you very much. All the best to you and
what's a website people can
viewers.
What's a website people can go to look at your stuff? No, I guess he signed off. All right, well, we'll be back in just a couple of minutes looking at the latest situation in Syria, whether it's a reality that the government used gas on people. We'll be talking with Patrick Lawrence. Just stay with us for just a couple of minutes. We got Chris Smither singing about diplomacy.
Anyway.
Diplomacy. Chris Smither rocking away. Wouldn't it be nice to have some actual diplomacy? My goodness, what a concept. Blustering and saying, oh, fire and fury like the world has never seen. Personally, I don't think that's a good idea. You know, I like the idea of having a State Department that functions, having actual policies. But hey, what do I know? I'm just your lovely radio guy here. And you can hear laughing at the other end, an old friend, Patrick Lawrence. Thank you so much for being with us. We're going to talk about Syria a bit today. Thanks for
sure.
being with us.
Good to be back, Bert.
Well, in case some listeners might not remember, Patrick Lawrence is a writer and columnist. He'd published 5 books and is now working on his 6th. He served as correspondent abroad for many years and is also an essayist, editor, and critic. Lawrence has taught at universities in the U.S. and abroad and lectures wildly, too.
So.
Depends on the crowd, I'm sure. He currently produces 2 commentaries weekly and biweekly, primarily on foreign affairs and the media. Patrick Lawrence was correspondent and subsequently a columnist overseas for nearly 30 years. He was only 5 when he started it, clearly. Chiefly for the honorable and now defunct Far Eastern Economic Review, the also honorable, also defunct International Herald Tribune, which I really enjoyed, and, of course, The New Yorker, the verbose New Yorker. He covered nearly every country in the region, a number of them extensively over many years, won an overseas press club award for his reportage taken from Korea. During the last years of the dictatorships, Lawrence served as news editor of the Herald Tribune's Asian edition before returning to the United States in 2010. He wrote a book that I recommend to everybody, Time No Longer, and it's more and more relevant with every passing day about the future past the American century, Time No Longer. Well, apart from his staff work, Lawrence's reportage, his commentary, essays, criticism, and reviews have appeared in the New York Times, Business Week, Time, The Washington Quarterly, World Policy Journal, The Globalist, The Nation, Asian Art News, and numerous other publications. He is now foreign affairs columnist at The Nation. And this quote that I saw today really grabbed my attention. This has to do with the apparent deaths of a lot of people, men, women, and children, from gas in Syria. Now, it's all almost universally accepted that Assad bombed his own people with gas. Now, this is the quote, and this is from your observation, Patrick, and I want to talk about this. You say, we are informationally quarantined. We, I assume that's the media, the press. We are informationally...
No, that's 320 million Americans.
Okay. Let me finish the quote. You're right, though.
Yeah.
In consequence, no peep as we risk war against a secular government in behalf of vicious religious extremists having arranged the necessary incidents as provocation. Wow. Tell us about that. Where does that quote come from? There's a lot to it. It's a very thick paragraph.
Now your listeners know what our early morning exchanges sound like. that was an email, of course, I sent you this morning. Bert, we are in a situation that I cannot recognize after 40-odd years in the great craft. Informational quarantine. The amount of information we are being deprived of regarding the Syria situation, and the amount of misinformation, and even more significantly, there's a difference, disinformation we are more or less drowning in, is I simply don't recognize my profession and those who populate it now, Bert. What happened, I must take respectful issue with one remark you made. Uh-oh. It's now almost universally accepted that Assad gassed his own people. I don't think so. It may be among Americans, but this is the consequence of the informational deprivation. It's not universally accepted anywhere else, and there's no evidence for it that we have yet seen. We have a serious problem, right? On the very face of it, whatever your listeners may choose to think, although we Americans prefer belief to thought.
Oh, absolutely.
Whatever the perspective, look at the very surface of it all. Nobody is willing to say chemical attack. It is always alleged or apparent. Apparent is the word of the moment,
sure.
Right? Nobody can say that. All right. We need to investigate. The Russian military police, parenthetically, have done so. They didn't find any evidence of it. But even stepping back from that, we are prepared to go to war on the basis of apparently.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how our political culture works. Innocence until guilt is proven, if you don't mind my saying so. We need to step very carefully. This is an extremely critical moment. As a friend of mine wrote to me the other day in another such note, we're closer to World War III than we have been since 1962.
Yes, absolutely.
This is getting very serious. And what caused me to write you this morning, I'm delighted you let your listeners share in that email, is a report by a really incomparably good journalist. I urge everyone to go and find him, named Max Blumenthal.
Uh-huh.
He writes from Washington. His what do I want to call it, institution, his publication is the Gray Zone Project. The Gray Zone, Max edits it and writes quite a lot of it. He came out with a report this morning concerning what is called the Syrian American Medical Society, SAMS, right? SAMS advertises itself as a non-political, non-partisan, non-everything group of doctors who attend to the injured and malnourished and so forth in Syria, all right?
Okay.
Max did his work. I think this guy must have more than 24 hours in his day. This report is exceptional, right? And he uncovers what SAMS actually is. It is a State Department-funded front that is dedicated to what we excuse ourselves by calling regime change. It's into coups,
yes.
Right? It's into a coup in Damascus. That's what this organization is.
Wow.
The thing about Max is he's got dollars and cents, chapter and verse. It's all there, right? I'll read the headline for your listeners.
Okay.
It's Al-Qaeda's MASH unit, how the Syrian American Medical Society is selling regime change and driving the U.S. to war. There's only one conclusion you can draw from this report. One, we are assaulted with disinformation as to what's going on in this region. Two, all of this information comes from what we call, what the Times and other newspapers call, rebels. I wrote in a column a few weeks ago, every time that term is used, it is a breach of professional ethics. I say that as a former practitioner. These are not rebels. They're Islamic extremists. They want to depose a secular government and install an Islamist government that rules by Sharia law. That's what we want in the Middle East.
Oh my.
One more remark, Bert, if I may.
Sure.
If your readers find this far-fetched, don't bother wondering. Go back to Afghanistan, 1979, when Zbigniew Brzezinski persuaded Carter to back a bunch of Islamic radicals in Afghanistan in order to sink the Soviet presence in that very eternally messy country, right? We dumped hundreds of millions of dollars into a loose organization we now know as Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
And I urge your listeners to contemplate that, because what we're watching now is a more or less perfect carbon copy. I'll leave it back to you, Bert.
Well, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, our guest today, Patrick Lawrence. We're talking about the alleged gas attack, allegedly by the government of Syria on its people. What about, we see these pictures of, horrible pictures of
right.
kids dying, apparently, of gas. My guess is there are other explanations. Like last year, I remember just about a year ago, in April 2017, when there was an alleged gas attack, allegedly by the government. Well, we found out later it was not true. The government
right.
did not attack with gas.
Our defense secretary said two, three months ago, we actually have no evidence of the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons. Right? Your listeners can look that up.
It's amazing to me what needs to be done
here. I said we're playing with real fire here, and that's why there's alarm in my voice.
Yes, it is amazing. I mean, I lived through 1962, and you're right. This is a heck of a lot more dangerous and trigger finger. We have, at least Khrushchev seemed to have some sanity to him. I mean, Kennedy was very macho, but
let's go to this question you just raised about these pictures.
Yes, please.
Okay, pictures. Depict images, what is in what we used to call the negative. I don't know what they call it in digital age, but they depict what is in front of the camera. That's true. They provide no context. They are greatly preferred by people like Nikki Haley, our ambassador at the UN. They were previously preferred by Samantha Power, who counts among her friends, indeed, the Syrian American Medical Society. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Pictures are quite useful. They're essential on some occasions, of course. They're also very easily manipulated, and they can very easily be used to mislead. Context. Don't leave home without it.
Hmm.
No. What is the context of those pictures?
Right.
Who took them? How did those children get in that condition, whatever it was? Max Blumenthal has an interesting little tale about Aleppo in the final days before the Syrian Arab army shoved all the radicals out. Right? A group called the White Helmets.
They're
supposed to be another neutral sort of civil society group dedicated to non-everything assistance, quite closely affiliated with the Syrian American Medical Society, if you don't be surprised, okay?
Mm.
The White Helmets were discredited a long time ago. That's all over the internet, if you wish, right? Now, we have pictures from Aleppo. There's a very famous picture, famous enough so that the little boy in it is called the Dusty Boy. It was on the front page of all the papers. Look at this poor child, right?
Mm-hmm.
The father of the child, after it was taken, came out and said, one of the White Helmets came up to me while I was holding my boy, grabbed him out of my arms, shoved him into an ambulance, and took his picture. Okay? That's on the record, named source, right? The father was extremely upset because he supports the government of the country where he lives.
Oh, my. And the boy did look upset. He was probably rather upset at being taken out of the arms of his father.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're getting here. And I tell you, the proportion of it is quite beyond my imagining, Bert.
Yeah.
We are having this discussion, and I imagine a number of some proportion of your listeners will find it rather difficult to believe. They will say that Bert's guest today is bouncing off the walls or something.
No, sure, why not?
It's all in the record. It's really very surprising. Now, one other point here that's quite essential. The newspapers and magazines and websites and so forth that have created our narrative of this dreadful situation, what are their sources? Well, no correspondent will go into Syria because they do it all by phone and text and so forth. Who are they talking to? Well, they're talking to so-called activists. Who are the activists? Well, the activists are anti-Damascus people, right? They are sometimes, quotation marks, rebels.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to give a balanced picture of what is going on there? I am sorry. I would flunk a journalism 101 student who claimed such a thing.
That's pure propaganda. Right. Well, I wanted to ask, too, and people have brought this up, what would Assad's motivation be to do what he's charged with doing? They are winning. They are close to victory. They've pretty much wiped out ISIS. The rebels are without anything. Why would they... What would they gain from making the entire world furious at them?
Excellent. Motivation. Motivation. Yes, yes. We have to go to motivation. Good. Very good of you to bring this up, Bert. This attack last Saturday, there was an attack. There was a very serious assault on the region in question, Eastern Ghouta, by the Syrian Arab Army. There's no question of that.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't been given any context. The context was that the Russians, who get no credit for this parenthetically, have been for a long time brokering peace talks between the Islamists and Damascus, the Assad government. Hmm. They've had numerous rounds of talks. No, you have not read about any of these talks in the New York Times.
Not a
word. I can guarantee you, you haven't.
Yep.
And these talks always break down. Why? Because... you can get accounts of this, good, solid, detailed accounts of this, because the rebels break the agreement, because the rebels consent to safe passage corridors for civilians, and then when the civilians get out on the safe passage corridors, kidnap them, arrest them, imprison them, shoot them, right? And they had an agreement just prior to last weekend's assault, yet another agreement, probably the third, possibly the fourth, broke down. Apparently the reason is the rebel command is divided. Some people want to say, we're done. We can't make this happen. And others say, no, we are going to try one more time. In any event... the agreement broke down. The Assad government had had enough, and they went in there big time. There is no question of that.
They did.
Now, would they use chemical weapons at this moment, as you ask? They had 90% of the territory at that time. Why would they do that?
Right.
There is no logical reason for them to do so. Let's turn the coin over. Why would radical Islamists who... this group, the Army of Islam, the dominant group there, they are on record. This is recorded. They've put civilians in cages and used them as human shields, all this sort of stuff.
Wow.
These are the people we now propose to go
freedom fighters
to war in behalf of.
Uh-huh.
Why would they want to have a chemical attack? Because it's their last chance to get the Americans involved, stir them up, infuriate them,
right,
and get them to come in. And that's where we land right now.
Well, what about Theresa May and Emmanuel Macron? They seem to be buying into it as well. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, Macron is a very hawkish fellow, right? He is right out front. What his core motivations are, I confess I cannot read. I don't have Macron down in foreign affairs. The French, for many years before Macron, Hollande, the socialist president, had the same streak.
No, sir.
Right?
No.
I don't know what they're trying to prove, but Macron, as you point out, has been rather incautious in his unqualified commitment to go in. What he will do, I don't know. Maybe he will step back from his rhetoric. Theresa May is in another kind of fix. She's just coming out of the Sergei Skripal
story.
Nerve agent case, and that's come unraveled to the point where nobody even wants to talk about it. I'll advise your listeners, watch as that whole episode rather gently fades away. No one really talking about it very much, right? That's how these things are disposed of when they fall apart.
And certainly,
the story's just gotten her into trouble. And she now, by British law, they don't actually have a constitution the way we do, but by British law precedent, I don't know whether she is obliged to go to Parliament before joining in any American effort to attack Syria. Some MPs say she must. The May government says she does not have to. And we'll have to see about that. But this is what we know already. She is perfectly aware that if she goes in, she's quite exposed politically at home.
Yeah.
There are a lot of MPs who are against this.
Yeah.
You know, Corbyn's doing very well. All his people will be dead against it. And remember, Tony Blair destroyed his reputation, his carefully cultivated reputation over many years. He's politically dismissed now because of his incaution over the invasion of Iraq in 2003. I'm quite sure Theresa May has that on mind, too.
Well, it's also true that France and formerly Great Britain have had interests in the Middle East for quite some time, imperial interests. It's like a long tradition. Well, I just want to ask about...
The French are not going to go into Syria, which they divided between themselves and the British in 1920, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to go back in there for the sake of history books. there has to be some kind of material or geopolitical interest, and I regret, I fail your listeners by not being able to explain it. I don't quite get Macron on the foreign policy side yet.
Well, there's time yet. There is Iran in this whole mix. You know, the U.S. has been seething, trying to, you know, paint Iran as the bad guys. Now, Iran suffered gas from their war with Iraq, which I believe we supported the Iraqi side sort of quietly. What is the reality around Iran in all this?
You know, you may have just tipped into one reason Macron is being so hawkish. The Europeans greatly, passionately want to save the Iran nuclear accord, as they should. They are very united about that, as are the Russians and the Chinese, the other signatories, right? And Trump is threatening to trash it. We all know that. He's just hired as his new national security advisor, John Bolton.
Yeah.
You and I discussed that not so long ago.
Yeah.
They're desperate to save that. It could be that the French, the English, British, and the Germans, but the Germans don't get into this sort of stuff.
No,
right?
I don't think so.
The French and the British may be moving to Trump's side on this to mollify him and say, now look, Donald, we got that done in Syria. Now let's keep this accord in place. Right? Numerous people, it's a possibility,
yeah,
but numerous people recognize that Iran is a regional, is an emergent regional power.
Absolutely.
I do not count this as anything anybody can prevent. If you look at a map and study the Iranian economy and Iranian statecraft and these things, it's inevitable, right? I don't think that's a bad thing if you strip back all the propaganda.
Absolutely.
Iran argues vigorously for a regional security agreement such that differences, for example, between Iran and the Saudis, right, the Syrians, can be managed cooperatively.
Yeah.
That's Iran's stated position, right? So I don't find it terribly disturbing that Iran is fated to become a regional power, but many, many other people do. Most of the leaders of the West do.
Well, apparently, and I found it fascinating. The one positive note was today the tweeter-in-chief, so he backed off his threat against Syria, saying, oh, I don't know, I didn't necessarily mean now, I didn't mean right away, I just maybe someday might.
I was thinking about that before you dialed the telephone, Bert. I was thinking, we don't really have any realistic option open to us by way of taking action. Any action we take at this point will have a deleterious effect. There's nothing that we can do. Our hands are tied. The only sensible thing we can do is step back. And the President of the United States was, in his way, quite incautious to say, it's coming and they're big. Terribly, rather reckless to say this, because now he's going to, the best thing he can do is eat humble pie, and you know how often people in Washington like that dish.
Not possible. Well, Patrick Lawrence, once again, thank you so much. Maybe there'll be less to talk about someday. I doubt it. Well, thank you again.
We'll talk about the lovely restaurants in Portsmouth.
That's true.
We're due for a lunch sometime soon anyway.
That is true. Thank you so much, Patrick Lawrence. And
you're welcome.
It's interesting, all the lies we have been fed.